with their mother and father, and if it turned out there was no way to destroy the reckoning without her dying, at least Emma knew that Gabriel would be waiting for her in the next world. She placed her hand on the book. The power rose up through her, filling her, and she saw the look in the boy's face, the understanding, and she imagined she could see the shimmering spirits of each Diamagnus clustered around him. Then, as she reached toward him with her mind, the words of the old white-eyed sorcerer, spoken in the world of the dead, returned. He wears the spirits of his former selves like armor. Suddenly Emma could see, in a way she never had before, and in the place of the physical boy, she saw a throbbing, glowing mass. It was the spirits of each of his former selves, grafted one onto the other. She could feel the different voices, the different selves of each Diamagnus. She could sense, too, the spirits of Michael and Kate, and how they had been sucked into that terrible, cancerous mass. Emma felt the air around her becoming more and more solid, trying to press her spirit from her as it had in the fortress days before. She was running out of time. She reached out with her mind, fixing upon one of those former selves, and stripped it away from the others. It was like peeling tar off tar. The spirit fought to stay connected. And as she pulled it free, the life of a Diamagnus who had existed hundreds of years before passed through her and through the book, and there were no memories of love. It was an empty, cold, hungry thing. And Emma held the spirit for a moment in her mind, then cast it into the world of the dead. She went quickly then, scarcely feeling the force pressing against her from the outside, pulling the spirit of each Diamagnus away from the mass. Some of them fought harder than others, but none had a single memory of love. And Emma could hear, as if from a great distance, the boy screaming for her to stop, vowing to kill her. But she paid him no mind, holding each spirit for a moment, then casting it into the world of the dead. And the magic was still filling her, pulsing through her, and Emma realized how terrified she'd been for so long, and how in the end there was nothing to fear, that the only thing you could control was the love you gave or withheld, and that was all that mattered. And finally, there was only Rafe's spirit, and one other, which clung like a spider to his own, and she knew it was the first Diamagnus, the one who had set it all in motion, and she reached out toward it. But as she did, the magic rose up, stronger than ever, and something inside Emma was torn apart. Kate lay without moving, having woken to the sound of Emma's voice. She knew her spirit had been taken from her and that the magic of the Atlas was gone. She knew because she had never felt so empty and desolate and weak. Finally, calling upon all her strength, she had managed to open her eyes and see Emma place her hand on the book and the Diamagnus fall to his knees. Then Emma cried out and collapsed. For a long moment, nothing happened. Then she watched as the boy, their enemy, she couldn't see his face, slowly pushed himself up and walked to where Emma lay. He seemed to be moving stiffly as if in pain. Emma had fallen forward on top of the book, and he rolled her over and picked it up. Then he knelt, holding his hand just above her body, and after a moment, Kate saw a shimmering rise out of her sister and begin to pass into him. She was on her feet before she knew it, seizing the sword still planted in the ground and racing toward the dark figure crouched over her sister. Unlike with the imp on the beach, her hand did not tremble. There was no hesitation. The sound of the rain muffled her footsteps, but perhaps he sensed her approach, for he rose and turned just as Kate reached him, having time only to hold out his hand, for her to meet his eyes and hear him say, "Kate!" And she drove the sword through his chest. Chapter 26. A Promise Kept, A Promise Made. Michael stood on the jetty, waving at the ship that was carrying away the last of the expanded army, in this case a clan of burly Bavarian cave dwarves, several of whom, Michael had noticed, had actual shrubs growing out of their beards. "Well, that's it," Michael thought. "So much for my military career." It had not taken the army long to disperse. It had only been a day since the battle had ended, a day since the Dire Magnus's forces had scattered and been destroyed, and already all the various factions and clans and races had drifted away, and the first of Loris's displaced families had begun to return. Even now, boats laden with homeward-bound refugees were maneuvering past the two giants, who stood waist-deep in the harbour, clearing away the ships that had been sunk during the battle. Behind him, King Robbie's dwarves were busy rebuilding the blasted-out sections of the city wall. The dwarves were providing their work and masonry expertise free of charge, which Michael thought was very generous of them, though he'd privately cautioned King Robbie that if you simply gave away high-quality craftsmanship, people would start to take it for granted. "Well, lad," the Dwarf King had said, "I think this time we'll let that pass." "Fair enough," Michael thought. "I warned him." Michael knew, too, that Wilhelmina, having been returned to perfect glowing health by a team of elfish physicians, was going around the damaged city on a personal beautification program, which basically entailed her walking around and smiling at people. The air was warm, and Michael took a deep breath, grateful that the towers of black smoke from the fires that morning, when the army had incinerated the bodies of the dead imps and trolls, apparently necessary for public health reasons, had been carried away by the sea breeze. A new day. People were getting on with their lives. It was probably good, Michael thought, that so few of them knew the truth. "Michael!" He turned, knowing whom he would see coming down the jetty. But it made no difference. The earth still seemed to shift under his feet. It was the same every time he saw his father, or his mother for that matter. Like Wilhelmina, they were both fully recovered from their wounds. The two old wizards, Jake and Beatles, despite spending most of their time insulting each other, had turned out to be remarkably capable healers. But it wasn't his parents' magically restored health that so unmoored Michael. It was the simple fact that they were here with them, that this was real and not a dream. "She's awake," his father said. "Emma's awake." Emma had woken to find herself in a bed with cool, clean sheets in a light-filled room, and her first realization had been that she was alive, and the way she had known this was that her entire body was one giant aching bruise. So that was the first thing. The second realization was that someone was sleeping in the chair beside her bed, and she'd almost said Kate's name before she saw that the person was not, in fact, her sister. Not unless Kate had suddenly aged 25 years. This had led to her third realization of who the woman in the chair had to be. Then her mother had opened her eyes. Throughout her childhood, Emma had imagined, just as Kate and Michael had imagined, what the reunion with their parents would be like. As Emma had had no memory of her parents, her mother and father had always presented themselves as generic, loving blobs. But she'd imagined what they would say, the various gifts they would bring, how she would wring from them the promise of a dog. There were a million different scenarios, most involving cake, tears, and a mountain of presents. In the end, what happened was that she and her mother had simply lunged for each other at the same moment, sobbing. And then her mother called, "Richard!" And her father ran in from the balcony and joined the hugging. After a few moments and after all the expected exclamations and queries, "It's really you! We were so worried! Are you sure you're okay?" And her mother explaining how Jake and someone else, Bug, was that right? A pair of old wizards they'd befriended, had fixed the wound in her hand. There were only faint, matching scars on Emma's palm and the back of her hand as evidence. Her father had kissed her and hurried out to find Michael. Alone with her mother, who continued to alternate between hugging Emma and holding her back to look at her, Emma had finally been able to register the fact that the magic of the reckoning was gone. On some level, she'd known it the moment she'd woken, but the appearance of her mother and father had pushed the knowledge to the edges of her mind. Only something about it didn't make sense. But before Emma could put her finger on what that something was, her father returned with Michael. Emma was sitting there, letting her mother hold her hand, and she almost laughed, seeing her father and brother together. They looked so much alike. "Michael," she cried, and ran and threw her arms around his neck. "Look, it's..." And though she couldn't quite say, "Mum and Dad," he understood. "But where's Kate?" she asked. "Why isn't she here?" Emma saw Michael glance at their mother, who shook her head. "You'd better sit down," Michael said. "I can tell you the whole story." Michael began at the moment of their parents' appearance on the beach, saying how he'd seen them both struck down by arrows. They'd been taken to the convalescent tent, and Michael explained how he'd followed them there, and had been about to use the Chronicle's magic to heal them, only before he could, both his spirit and the magic were taken from him. "I know," Emma said. "I mean, I know why."
"You do? That's great. I was hoping you would.
But tell your side first."
So he went on, saying how he was there in the tent, their parents both unconscious, and how everyone, King Robbie, King Bernard, everyone was yelling and arguing about what to do when he'd felt his spirit return.
"It was like I was all empty and cold inside. I'd never felt so awful, and then, I don't know, I was filled almost with light or something."
"Yeah," Emma said, "I know that feeling."
And there'd been a great cry from near the city wall, and King Robbie had shouted that all the imps and trolls were fleeing, while the Morumkadi were simply dissolving where they stood, as if the power that had fed them was cut off. And Michael said he had known instantly that Emma was back. Michael had left their mother and father with Jake and Beatles, and told King Robbie that he had to get to the citadel. And the dwarf king had shouted for guards, and they had joined the army that was streaming through the hole in the city wall, the dire Magnus's army evaporating before them. And Harold and Captain Anton had been at his side as well, and together they had run from the harbour all the way to the Rose Citadel, and they hadn't stopped running until they'd reached the centre of the garden.
"And that was where we found you, just lying there, unconscious."
"Can you tell us what happened, honey?" Claire said. "Or are you hungry? Do you need to eat something first?"
"I'm okay, but didn't Kate already tell you everything?"
"We'd like to hear it from you," Richard said.
"Sure," Emma said, though she was now wishing she'd asked for a cheeseburger or something. She was starving.
"I probably can tell it pretty good, leave out the boring bits. But when did you get here?"
"It's a long story," her mother said. "Gabriel found us. He told us where you were, but he..."
"This will be hard to hear."
"He's dead,"
Emma said quietly.
"I know."
"He died defending us," her father said, "while we were hunting down the end of the prophecy."
"That's what we were bringing here," Claire said. "Pym thought it was the secret to saving your lives."
"But we didn't need it. We did it on our own. We killed the Dire Magnus."
Emma paused, struggling to recall exactly what had happened in the garden.
"I mean, it's over, right? The reckoning isn't in me anymore. Is the Chronicle in you?"
Michael shook his head.
"No."
"Without a doubt, what you all did was incredible," her father said. "But we're still putting together the pieces. We need to hear your story from the beginning." Emma gave in. She didn't want to fight. Indeed, she didn't think she wanted to fight ever again.
and she started telling them how she had returned from the world of the dead, carrying the reckoning with her.
"What was it like?" Michael said. "The world of the dead."
Emma opened her mouth to answer, to tell him about the walkers, about Dr. Pym, about the carrier din and the cave in the cliff, how the dire Magnus had been consuming the souls of the dead, about Gabriel, and found she couldn't. She wasn't ready.
"It's okay," their mother said. "Just tell the parts you can."
So Emma told about finding Kate in the garden, and how the boy, the dire Magnus, had come upon them, and he'd offered her a chance to save her and her brothers' and sisters' lives by taking on their spirits, and she'd agreed. But once he'd taken Kate's and Michael's...
"That's what I felt," Michael said. "That's what happened."
She had tried to kill him with the reckoning, which she guessed made her kind of a liar. But you're allowed to lie to totally evil people, right? And she'd started peeling away the spirits from all the other incarnations of the dire Magnus and sending them back to the world of the dead. And then...
"What?"
Michael prompted.
"I don't know. It all went black. But I must have killed him. I mean, we won the battle, and now everything's fine."
"Not exactly," her mother said. "You see, the books
were tearing apart the world, but we destroyed them. I destroyed them. They were in him, and I..."
Emma fell silent. It had occurred to her why the magic of the reckoning being gone didn't make sense. While it was logical that Michael wouldn't have the Chronicle, as both it and the Atlas had been transferred to the dire Magnus, the reckoning had stayed in her. She'd held on to her spirit. So, what had happened? Where had the magic gone?
"That's the thing," her father said. "It seems that whatever the books were doing, it's just gotten worse. I hate telling you this after everything you've done, but Hugo Algernon, Magda von Klappen, all the magicians assure us it's so. They feel the tearing in a way that we don't."
"You can see the effects," Michael said, "down by the water. They've been dead fish washing up all morning, dozens of them. People think it's because of the battle, but Dr. Algernon said it's the books."
"But I killed the dire Magnus," Emma cried, clinging to the idea that this should have somehow fixed everything, even though it didn't explain what had happened to the reckoning. "I know I did. I killed him."
"Well," Richard said slowly, "we're not completely sure he is dead."
"What are you talking about?"
"He's gone," Michael said. "Vanished." Emma stood up. She had a terrible, awful, sick feeling.
"Where's Kate? I want to see her now. Where is she?"
"Emma," her mother took her hand, "when Michael found you in the garden, you were alone. Kate and the dire Magnus, they're both missing." Kate knelt beside the stream and tilted the bucket till it was full. The gurgling of the water, the only sound to be heard on the mountainside. Then she leaned down and drank, mouthful after mouthful of cold, clean water. When she was done, she stood and looked out over the mountains. The sun was setting. Soon it would be dark and much colder. She would make a fire. She hadn't during the day, for fear that someone might see the smoke. Kate searched the sky, but there were no birds to be seen. As she walked back along the path, she wondered again why she had chosen this place of all places. But there had been so little time to decide. Everything had happened so fast. She kept replaying the scene in her mind. Sword in hand, she had been charging forward when Rafe had turned, and then the tip of the sword had been at his chest. Her momentum carrying her relentlessly onward, the blade so sharp there'd been almost no resistance. He'd staggered back, collapsing against the tree. Instantly all her anger had melted away. She'd screamed his name, the sword dropping to the ground, and rushed to his side, pressing her hands against the wound in his chest, sobbing. And she'd seen a shimmering rise from his body,
and she saw and felt it pass into her, filling her up, warming her. And she knew it was her own spirit returning, that it was returning because Rafe was dying. And she'd watched two more shapes rise from his body, and one drift toward Emma, and another, Michael's spirit, it had to be, rise up out of the garden, vanishing into the darkness. "Please," she'd begged, "please don't die." And then she'd seen another shimmering form, and there had been something about it, some emanating malice that had made Kate shrink back in revulsion and fear, and then it too rose up and was gone. And Kate had still been staring after it when she'd felt a hand touch her own. "Kate!" He'd sat up, getting slowly to his feet, and she'd risen as well, too stunned to speak. And they'd stood there, she looking at him, he at her, the rain drenching them. And she'd known, with every fibre of her being, that it was him, only him. And then he'd stepped forward and kissed her. He'd said, "I've waited 100 years for that kiss. Rafe, how—" "Your sister stripped away the spirits of each Diamagnus that came before me, all save the first one. He wouldn't let go, till you stabbed me through the heart. I should have died, only the conicle wouldn't let me. It had bonded with my spirit, but he couldn't hold on. His spirit was pulled into the world of the dead. It's over." Then he'd looked off, as if seeing beyond the confines of the garden and citadel. "Your parents are here. They're in the harbour with Michael. Are they okay?"
"Yes."
"What is it?" For there was a strange expression on his face. "Your parents discovered something and told your brother. I learned about it when I took on his spirit. I wouldn't have known otherwise, though it makes sense."
"Tell me." "Not now." His eyes were closed. "It's amazing, the power of the magic, the sweep and depth of it. And it's all in me. Even this."
He'd held up the small black book.
"It's just a book."
Then he'd lowered it, saying, "Your friends are near. I have to go."
"But it's over."
"The others won't trust me. They don't—" He hadn't said it, but she'd known what he'd meant. They didn't love him.
"I'm coming with you."
"No."
"Yes, I'm coming with you."
"Kate?" She'd glanced at Emma on the ground, still unconscious.
"Is she okay?"
"Yes, so's your brother. He and the others will be here any moment." She'd stepped closer.
"I believed in you when no one else did. You owe me this."
He'd stared at her for a long moment, the rain sheeting down. Finally, he'd nodded and taken her hand. "Think of somewhere safe." And the ground had disappeared beneath her feet. Kate found Rafe sitting on a bench in front of the cabin, staring out over the valley. He had on a set of well-worn clothes he'd found in the cabin, and as she approached, he rose, took the bucket from her, and placed it on the ground. "It really is beautiful here. I'm glad you chose this place." Then he took her hand and drew her down beside him. When Rafe had told her to think of somewhere safe, she'd known he'd meant somewhere they could hide, and the first place that had come to mind had been Gabriel's cabin, outside of Cambridge Falls. Perhaps she'd thought of it because of Gabriel's sword lying in the clearing under the tree. But whatever the reason, the cabin turned out to be the perfect choice, alone on the mountainside, with no one nearby to disturb them. At least she hoped that was the case. They'd found the cabin well-provisioned, making Kate suspect that it was now used by people from Gabriel's village. So far, though, no one had stopped by. They had arrived just after dawn, one moment standing in the darkness and storm in the garden on Loris, the next here, the sun rising over the mountains, the air cool and still and heavy with mist. Then the release that had been building for days had finally come, and Kate had collapsed against him, sobbing. He'd half-led, half-carried her into the cabin, and they'd lain together on the bed where she'd slept with Michael and Emma years before, and he'd held her as she cried. Neither of them had spoken, content just to lie there, long after her tears had stopped. It had been midday when they'd finally risen, impelled by hunger and thirst, and they'd found food in the cabin, and Kate had made her first trip to the stream. Alone, she had allowed herself to think about her brother and sister, about her parents, to wonder if they were okay. Rayford promised they were, and to hope that they weren't worrying about her, though she knew they must be. Neither had yet mentioned the future, as if by not doing so the future wouldn't exist, and there would only ever be this present. They had spent the day wandering together in the woods, never straying far from the cabin. Kate had imagined they looked like any normal boy and girl, and there were moments, like now, sitting beside him, his hand solid and warm in hers, that she could almost convince herself that was true. If only it hadn't been for the birds. She and Rafe had been returning to the cabin when they'd heard a great rushing that had grown louder and louder. They had climbed a large rock in a clearing and looked out over the trees to see a dark curtain being drawn across the sky. As the massive flock had come overhead, the sun had been blotted out, and all around them birds had launched themselves out of the trees to join the migration. It had taken more than an hour for the flock to pass, but even that had only been the beginning. All afternoon they had watched animals, bears and deer and foxes and raccoons, moving through the forest in the same direction as the birds, as if heeding some silent alarm. Kate knew what it meant, and knew Rafe knew, but neither spoke of it. "We're together now," she told herself. "That's all that matters." After the sun had set, the temperature dropped quickly, and she and Rafe rose from the bench and went inside. Rafe lit the fire, and together they made a stew out of the carrots and onions and salted meat they'd found in the cabin's hutch, adding in sliced bits of ginger and sprigs of parsley from jars in the cupboard. While it cooked, Rafe asked her to tell the story of the first time she and Michael and Emma had come to Cambridge Falls. And she told about leaving Baltimore on the train, arriving at the house, finding the Atlas, being captured by the Countess, escaping, fleeing from the wolves, how Gabriel had saved them and brought them here through the rain. She stopped and looked at him. "You must already know all this. I like hearing you tell it." They ate, sitting on the hearth, shifting as the heat from the fire became too great. When she finished the story, she was silent for a moment, then looked at him, the shadows and light moving over his face. "Can I ask you something?"
"Of course."
"What was it like?" She didn't explain what she meant, but he understood. "It was like I was pushed down deep inside myself, like I was watching the world through someone else's eyes.
Like you were a puppet."
He shook his head. "No, I mean, partly yes, but I was also the Diamagnus." "It's important you know that." "Those other voices in my head, they urged me to do things, pushed me, but they played on things that had always been there. Anger, bitterness, hunger for power and revenge, all that was in me already." Kate looked down for a long moment, and when she lifted her gaze, her eyes glistened in the firelight.
"But love, too, that was in you."
He nodded.
"Yes, that too."
He set his bowl on the hearth and leaned toward her.
"I can't stay much longer."
She shook her head, not so much arguing as refusing to listen, as if by talking about what was coming, he had broken some compact between them. He took her hand.
"You know what the books are doing. The fact that the magic is in me instead of in you and your brother and sister hasn't changed what's happening to the world. You saw the birds, the animals. They sense it too. Things are coming apart."
Hugo Algernon said that maybe there's a way.
There isn't. Remember I said that your parents had found out the end of the prophecy?
Kate looked up. She couldn't help herself.
I told you in the garden. I learned about it when I took on Michael's spirit. The prophecy says that three will become one. Three books in one. Three keepers in one. And it says the final keeper must die to heal the world. Otherwise...
Otherwise what?
Kate said furiously.
The world's going to end? I don't believe it, and I don't care. It's not fair. Not after everything.
She stood, flinging her bowl across the cabin.
I don't care. I can't.
But she couldn't even finish her statement. Kate let him hold her then, and time passed. All day she tried not to think about the power of the books being inside him, and how that included the power of the reckoning. Did that mean all he had to do was wish himself dead, simply think it, and it would be so? She hated the idea of him having that power.
Kate.
She sat up, turning to face him. He was staring at her intently. Do you understand what Emma did in the world of the dead?
She gave the dead back their memories.
But do you understand what that means? Now, when someone dies, they carry with them all the love they had in life, forever. It's a great, great thing.
Why are you telling me this?
Because it's important you know it. What happened to your locket?
The chain broke, but
show me. She paused just a second, then reached into her pocket and pulled out the locket and chain. Rafe pressed the broken links between his fingers, and when he opened them, the chain was whole again. He slipped it over her head, and she felt the familiar weight settle on her chest.
Do something for me, he said.
Anything. That locket, it always made you think of your mother, the promise you made.
Yes.
And you kept your promise. Your brother and sister are safe with your parents, so maybe now, when you wear it, you can think of me.
Kate turned away. Tears ran down her cheeks and fell into her lap.
He took her hand.
Promise me?
And she nodded and said quietly,
Yes, that promise.
Then she gripped his hand with all her strength and looked at him, her vision blurry with tears.
Isn't there anything I can do?
There has to be something.
There is, he said. You can live.
All day there had not been a cloud in the sky, and so when the storm came, it came without warning. Rain beat against the side of the cabin. The windows and doors shuddered in the gale. The wind screamed down the chimney and scattered ashes across the room. It had seemed to Kate that this was the same storm that had been over Loris the night before, that the storm had somehow followed them here. She'd resolved not to fall asleep. She would stay awake as long as she had to. She would not lose a single moment. And she wondered later if Rafe had done something to make her sleep, or if the days of struggle and strain had finally caught up to her. She had a vague memory of being carried to bed. When she woke, the cabin was filled with sunlight. The storm had ended, and all was still and peaceful. She looked at Rafe beside her, then rose and walked outside, glancing on her way at the black leather book on the table. She sat down on the bench. The morning was cool, and she closed her eyes and listened to the birds all across the mountainside calling the new day. It had been his choice in the end. The power had been his, and he'd used it to save them all, to save her. She tried to keep that thought in mind. But inside her was an emptiness she had never imagined possible. She was not surprised when, a while later, she heard noises and looked to see Michael and Emma emerging from the trees. She stayed where she was,
waiting till they got to the cabin, and she could take them inside and show them where Rafe's body lay. Chapter 27 Goodbye, Farewell. Kate chose to bury Rafe close by the cabin, in sight of the bench where they had sat on that last day, and watched the sun sink below the mountains. And she stayed with him all night in Gabriel's village, while Granny Pete prepared his body for burial, cleaning his hands and face, combing his hair, whispering blessings. It had been Granny Pete, of course, who had sensed her and Rafe's presence at the cabin and spread the word that had drawn the others. In the end, Kate was glad that she was not alone, and Emma, Michael, her mother and father, they all took turns sitting with her throughout the night. In the morning, with the help of Robbie McClower and his dwarves, they carried Rafe back up the mountain to where the grave had already been dug. The only ones in attendance were Kate and her family, Granny Pete, Hugo Algernon, King Robbie and his dwarves, and Princess Wilhelmina, who was dressed almost demurely in black silk. Once he was laid in his coffin, Kate placed the reckoning on Rafe's chest, beneath his folded hands. Then she stepped back as the lid was settled into place and the nails hammered home. With her mother and Emma beside her, she watched as the coffin was lowered into the ground. They spent that night as well in Gabriel's village, eating dinner in the tribe's main building. Michael knew many of the men to nod to, having fought alongside them during the battle. They slept, though Kate did not sleep, in a cabin given over to their family, and though no one said anything directly, it felt strange to Kate, and she knew it must have been strange for Michael and Emma to be spending the night under the same roof as two adults they scarcely knew, even if they were their mother and father. But her mother seemed to sense it, for as she kissed her goodnight, she whispered, "I'm sorry about this. It will get better." "What will?" Kate asked. "Everything." The next day, Hugo Algernon left, as did Wilhelmina, though she promised to return as soon as possible. And so there was only Kate, her family, Granny Pete, and King Robbie, who came dressed in his finest armor, and a few attendant dwarfs, when they climbed the mountain to bury Gabriel in the grave that had been dug alongside Rafe's. Gabriel's body had been recovered from the village on the Arabian Peninsula, and Emma placed his sword, brought from the garden on Loris, in the coffin beside him. After the coffin was lowered into the ground, Granny Pete asked Emma if there was anything she wanted to say.
"No," Emma said. "I already told him."
And King Robbie himself filled in the grave, and it was done. Their parents and Granny Pete and the Dwarf King all moved off, and Kate stood with her brother and sister beside the pair of fresh graves, and though none of them spoke, Kate thought, and she imagined Michael and Emma thinking the same, of how both Gabriel and Rafe had died for them, and that was a thing impossible to repay. That afternoon, after saying goodbye to Granny Pete and thanking her for everything, they followed Robbie McClure over the mountains to the house in Cambridge Falls, the house where they had first found the Atlas, where they had met Dr. Pym. It was perhaps a strange place to return to, but none of them, neither the children nor their parents, were quite ready to re-enter the real world. Once in sight of the house, the Dwarf King said his farewells, hugging each of the children and kissing them on both cheeks, assuring them they would always be welcome in his kingdom, and inviting them to return as often as they liked, and more often still. Then, shaking hands with their father and bowing to their mother, he walked off into the woods and was swallowed by the gathering dark. Kate, Emma, Michael, and their parents walked on to the house, where they found Abraham, the old caretaker, and Miss Sallow, the cook, waiting for them on the front steps. After having been hugged and exclaimed over by Abraham, and nodded curtly to by Miss Sallow, who had to rub her eyes with her apron because the blasted stove so smoky, though she was outside at the time and nowhere near the stove, the children and their parents were brought inside, where they found a hot and bountiful dinner already waiting. It was the first time they had felt truly alone as a family, and as such, it was a vision of the future. Their parents talked nervously throughout the meal, as if trying to fill the silences, but in truth, the children hardly noticed the awkwardness. Being in the house and eating Miss Sallow's food, they had realized how utterly, deeply, bone-crushingly tired they were. They found they could hardly chew, and soon they were being led upstairs, almost dropping with fatigue, to their old room, which Abraham had made up hours before. The children and their parents stayed in the house for more than 2 weeks, eating, resting, and getting used to the idea of being a family. At first it was strange for Kate to no longer be the one responsible for her brothers and sisters' safety and well-being, but she couldn't deny that every day she felt lighter, as if she'd set aside a little more of the weight she'd carried for 10 years. She sensed, however, that the day would come when she would miss the weight and wish it back. Beyond that, those first days were trying for everyone. For as much as the children had yearned to be reunited with their parents, and as much as Richard and Claire had yearned for and missed Kate and Michael and Emma, no one could pretend that the years apart had never happened. They had to get to know each other, and that would take time. It was easier at meals, which Kate partly attributed to Miss Sallow's cookingwhich was as mouth-wateringly delicious and nourishing as always, so much so that Kate wondered if the woman wasn't just a little bit of a witch. But they couldn't always be at meals, and after all the years of looking forward to being together, it was hard when things weren't immediately perfect.
"It's okay," Claire assured Kate.
Not surprisingly, Kate and her mother found their footing first, and soon the two of them were taking walks in the woods around the house.
"Your father and I understand. It's going to take time."
It was on one of their walks that Claire told Kate how this was not her and Richard's first visit to Cambridge Falls. They had been there once before.
"It was just after your adventure here, though before any of you were born. Stanislaus had told us who you were destined to be, what you would do. Imagine not having any children and then hearing that you're going to have 3, and they're going to be at the heart of this ancient prophecy. We talked him into bringing us here, and we saw them, all the children you'd saved. We were so proud of you, and you hadn't even been born yet. That day, Richard and I both knew that whatever life had in store for you, we had to trust that you would be strong, you would stand by each other, and you would survive. And you have."
It was also during one of their walks that her mother pointed out the locket Kate was wearing, the one she'd given her the night they'd been separated.
"You held on to it all this time." "Yes, I'm glad. I've always imagined you wearing it."
"I'm going to keep wearing it," Kate said, and her hand went to it, clutching it, as if her heart lived not in her chest, but in the small golden chamber. And if her mother sensed there was something Kate wasn't telling her, she let it be. Soon enough, too, Michael and their father had begun to find their way toward each other. It started when Michael apologized about losing his dwarf omnibus, and his father had told him not to worry. In fact, he'd heard that G.G. Greenleaf had put out a new edition, and Robbie McClower had promised to send him one, and he and Michael could read it together. From there, they seemed to be talking about dwarves whenever Kate saw them, and their comfort with each other, their sense of being two kindred souls, only increased. Though once, Kate heard Michael correcting his father, telling him,
"Well, the truth is the elves aren't silly at all. It's a common enough misconception, but you should try and get past it. It's very small-minded."
Then one day, in the middle of the second week, Kate saw Michael entering the house and his eyes were red and swollen. She asked if something had happened.
"Oh,"
he said, pulling out his handkerchief and blowing his nose with a loud honk, while making an offhand comment about summer allergies, though it was nearly autumn.
"Wilhelmina was just here.
She couldn't stay. Her people are looking for a new home. Now that the Chronicle's gone, their valley in Antarctica has frozen over, and with the portal to the world of the dead closed, there's kind of no reason to be there. They're thinking about moving to the magical quarter of Paris, but apparently it's really expensive.
Uh-huh.
And we decided, you know, after talking it over, that we would just be friends. I mean, I'm probably going to be really busy with school soon, and it turns out her dad's retiring as king. Something about the stress being bad for his hair. So she'll have to take over. It was a mutual decision, of course.
I guess it's for the best, Kate said, but she hugged him tightly, and he let her, while muttering something about wartime romances burning brightly, but not long.
It was Emma who had the hardest time with their parents. Following that first morning after the battle, when Emma had seen her mother and hugged her and cried, she had pulled back. It was almost, Kate thought, as if Emma wasn't convinced that her parents were there to stay, as if she thought that she and Kate and Michael might wake up one day and find their parents gone, and the three of them on their way to the next orphanage. She even avoided calling them Mum and Dad, referring to them instead, when she was alone with Kate and Michael, as him and her. Her mother insisted that she and their father understood.
It'll take time, that's all. We've just got to prove to her we're not going anywhere.
They were more concerned about what else might be weighing on Emma, the ordeals and trials she had gone through, which she refused to discuss.
We're not saying she has to open up to us, Richard said. It could be to you or Michael. It would just help her to talk.
But Kate, who knew her sister, insisted that no one pressure her.
She's been through a lot. She lost her best friend. She'll tell her story when she's ready.
The truth was, Kate herself was worried. Every day she waited for Emma to come to her, to tell her all that had happened, and every night they went to bed, and Emma turned her back to Kate and curled away, as if closing herself around her grief. Then, a few days after Wilhelmina's visit, as they were all sitting down to dinner, their mother set aside her knife and fork, reached for their father's hand, and said,
"It's been wonderful being here. Abraham and Miss Sallow have been very kind."
"Well," Richard said, "Abraham has."
Claire gave their father a look, then went on,
"But we've been talking, and maybe it's time we thought about going home."
"Home?" Emma said.
"Home like where?"
"Home," their father said. "Our home, your home."
Kate wondered what reaction their parents had expected. Probably not total stunned silence. But the fact was, neither Emma nor even Michael, they'd both been too young, had ever really thought of themselves as having a home. Their only memories of the places they'd lived had been years of being bounced from one orphanage to another. And the news that they did have a home waiting for them, and they would be returning to it soon, was almost too large and strange a concept to process.
"Okay," Kate said, answering for all of them.
"Yeah," Michael said.
Emma said nothing. But the next morning she woke Kate up and said she wanted to go back to Gabriel's cabin, just the three of them, to say goodbye. When asked, Abraham said he knew the way and could draw them a map, which was fortunate as none of the children had paid much attention when walking with King Robbie. Abraham also said that if they left after breakfast, they could be back before dark, and Miss Sallow agreed to pack them lunch, though she said that on such short notice there was no way she could prepare foie gras pastries or truffle galettes. So their highnesses might as well chop off her head now, shoot fireworks at it, and be done.
"Whatever you make will be fine," Kate told her.
"You're sure this is okay? I mean, it's safe?"
their mother asked when Kate explained their plans, but she immediately corrected herself.
"What am I saying?
Everything you all have been through. You can take a walk in the woods alone. Just now that we have you back, I guess I'm feeling protective.
We'll be fine, Kate said.
So the following day, after a breakfast of poached eggs, lemon curd pancakes, bacon as thick as sausage, and crispy buttery potatoes, and after Michael rechecked his map several times with Abraham and double and triple checked his equipment, which was more suited to a 3-week journey than a day-long hike, they set off. As soon as they began walking, it was a cool, early fall morning. The air was clean, the pine needles and earth slightly damp from a drizzle the night before. Kate knew that this was a good thing they were doing, that it was important and necessary to be out and alone, the three of them, in the place where it all began. And more than that, it was just good to be tramping through the forest. Magic or not, Kate could feel something working on her, on all of them. The children walked in silence, and there was no sound but the calls and whistles of birds, the skittering of squirrels along branches, and the muffled thuds of their own feet. Michael diligently made corrections to the map that Abraham had drawn so that he could show the caretaker his mistakes when they returned.
"He'll appreciate it," he assured his sisters.
After walking for an hour, they stopped on a ledge that looked out over the mountains. They'd gotten hot and stuffed their sweaters into their packs, and they sat there in the sun, drinking water and eating apples. And it was then that Emma began telling her story. She began simply, with no preamble or warning, describing what it had been like to arrive in the world of the dead. The hours, or what had felt like hours, of hiking through the mist, her coming upon the walkers. She told them how she'd met Dr. Pym, but he hadn't remembered her. How they'd travelled across a sea and then through the burning, wasted landscape. She told about the Caryadin, and how they'd guarded the book for thousands of years, and how the first time she'd touched it, she'd been overwhelmed by the voices of the dead. She told about being a prisoner and discovering how the dire Magnus had been consuming the souls of the dead, about encountering the Countess, her body twisted and mangled, and how the witch had helped her. She told how the Necromantus had pinned her hand onto the book with Michael's knife, bonding her spirit to the magic. Kate and Michael both noticed her unconsciously rubbing the scar on her palm as she said this. And she told them about Gabriel appearing, and how it had saved her, how she'd given the dead back their memories with the question she'd posed, and how that question would judge the dead from now till the end of time. She told them how she and Gabriel and Dr. Pym had gone to the last portal, and how both of them had chosen to stay in that world rather than let Michael bring them back, and how she'd said goodbye to Gabriel, standing there on the cliff, and how he'd promised that he would never forget her.
"Anyway," she said, after she had been silent for a moment, "that's what happened, and now he's gone."
When Kate reached for her sister's hand, Emma didn't pull away. Then Michael said,
"So the dead will remember us. Dr. Pym and Wallace and Gabriel, they'll remember us."
"Yes,"
Emma said. Kate felt her heart tighten in her chest, and her hand went to her locket. She saw Emma looking up at her.
"I'm okay."
Then she said,
"We all are, aren't we?"
And Emma, squeezing her sister's hand, said,
"Yes, we are."
Then they lifted their packs and continued on. The sun was not quite at the top of the sky when they came around a bend in the path, and there, tucked into the shoulder of the mountain, was Gabriel's cabin. They ate on the small bench beside the front door, and though Miss Sallow's lunch was no doubt exquisite, afterward none of them could quite remember what it had been. Then they walked over to the two markers, and already the ground had been tamped down and trodden on by animals, and looked little different from the rest of the mountainside, which was, as it should be, the children felt. Kate and Michael left Emma alone to say goodbye to Gabriel while they went and loaded their packs. Emma came back several minutes later,
wiping her eyes, and, knowing it was her turn, Kate walked over to the graves. She stared down at the patch of earth that held Rafe's body, while her fingers worried the golden locket. She tried to think of what to say, but none of it sounded right. Finally, she knelt, placed her hand on the still damp ground, whispered, "I love you," and walked away. Michael and Emma had already shouldered their packs, and Michael glanced at her, questioning, and she nodded, not yet trusting herself to speak.
"We'd better get going," Emma said. "Mum and Dad will worry if we're not back by dark."
Kate and her brother both stopped what they were doing and looked at her. Emma smiled awkwardly.
"I know, feels weird calling them that. And weird knowing that there are people out there who worry about you. But I guess it's good."
She was silent then, and Kate and Michael waited, knowing she wasn't done. Finally, she said,
"I thought giving the dead back their memories would make everything better. But really, it doesn't change anything, at least not while you're alive. The people you love are still going to die. You're still going to lose them."
Kate watched Emma closely, seeing shades of the sister she'd known, brave, reckless, thoughtless, and this new person, who'd grown up in her place, who was working through what she was feeling, piece by piece.
"Then I realized, maybe that's okay. Maybe it's even okay loving someone, knowing it's going to end. That either you're going to die, or they're going to die, or you'll move away and never see them again. Because that's what it means to be alive. That's the whole point of life, to love someone."
And she looked up at her brother and sister, her eyes wide and shining with tears.
"Don't you think?"
And Kate took her hand and said,
"Yes, I do."
The end. This is Jim Dale. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Black Reckoning, Book 3 of the Books of Beginning by John Stevens. This program was directed by John McElroy, executive producer Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2015 by John Stevens. Production copyright 2015 Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.